Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Agriculture Report and Science in the News, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you will hear about important things that are happening around the world. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we turn to a problem that affects many Africans, the forced marriage of young girls. The African Union is working to stop this troubling practice. Then, we are off to the western state of California to learn about two large ethnic groups. Some experts point out that while there are many cultural differences, there are also many similarities. 7 days a week, we give you our world as it is. In most African countries, at least 30% of all girls are married before they reach age 18. Many of these girls become a man's wife against their will. The high number of young wives has led the African Union to launch a 2-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa. Parents in developing countries force 14 million girls below the age of 18 to get married each year. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zinabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married. She says her husband beat her if she did not want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they also beat her and returned her to her husband. She later ran away to another family member and now wants to return to school. Girls married at a young age often develop mental disorders. They may also suffer other health problems because of an early pregnancy, and they are less likely to get an education. Most of the girls come from poorly educated families and rural areas where young women cannot oppose cultural traditions. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is aimed at policy action and on raising understanding of the problem. Olawale Mayegun is the director of the AU's Social Affairs Commission. He says AU member countries should follow and enforce laws and policies that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the Commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad. The rates there are above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries are working together to bring that rate down. Nkandu Luo is the Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign is done in cooperation with African governments, civil society organizations, and the United Nations Children's Fund. More immigrants live in the western state of California than anywhere else in the United States. Among the largest immigrant groups are Mexicans and Chinese. They may have come to the country legally or without legal documents. The two ethnic groups come from very different places, but they share many similarities. 21-year-old Jonathan Wong is a fourth-generation Chinese and a third-generation Mexican-American. But people often wonder about his ancestry.
They go, "Are you Filipino? Are you Mexican? Are you Pacific Islander? Are you Hawaiian?"
Although the cultures of his ancestors are very different, Jonathan Wong finds there is one thing both deeply value.
The connection you have with your family in general, both of them are very family-oriented.
Like many immigrants, his Mexican and Chinese ancestors came to the U.S. for a better life. Shelley Fisher Fishkin is director of the American Studies Program at Stanford University in California.
The Chinese who came to the U.S. in the middle of the 19th century and then Mexicans who came at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, were lured by the possibility of creating opportunities for their families that were not possible in their home countries.
The new immigrants often faced hardship and discrimination. They worked as laborers, either as modern-day Mexican farm workers or as Chinese railroad workers in the 19th century. An art show examines the two immigrant experiences. The exhibit can be seen at the Chinese American Museum in Los Angeles. One artwork has railroad tracks buried under a small mountain of fortune cookies. Artist Hung Liu created the work. It is meant to represent the early Chinese immigrants who came to dig for gold or work on the railroads.
The very reason the Chinese first came here is to escape from the economic despair in China.
Stephen Wong is the curator of the Chinese American Museum. He says immigrants from China and Mexico still come to the U.S. He adds that immigration remains an important issue.
I think not a lot of people realize that there still is a lot of unskilled labor coming in from both communities. And not a lot of people know, too, when it comes to immigration and immigration reform, usually people associate that with, oh, that's a Latino issue. But that is also a big Asian issue of undocumented immigrants coming in, also specifically Chinese.
In the Los Angeles area, both groups often live in ethnic neighborhoods. Artist Tony De Los Reyes experienced this while growing up in Los Angeles. Mostly Mexican, East Los Angeles is one ethnic area. Next to it is Monterey Park, a mainly Chinese community. While these immigrant groups may live near each other, Tony says the two do not often mix.
You're going to have this push and pull between not wanting to be in a place because culture is different, and then also being attracted to it.
But Jonathan Wong says such borders are becoming less clearly defined. That is why he is not surprised that his parents met and got married.
Look how much like blending there is, and it's not even weird at all, like how they would have met or how they could have, came across each other and, hit it off.
He expects more mixing of the two cultures in other parts of the United States as immigrants and their families continue to seek the American dream. Before we move aside for two more Learning English programs this hour, here is a brief history lesson for you. On this date in 1864, the bloody Battle of Cold Harbor took place during the American Civil War. More than 7,000 soldiers were killed during the first 30 minutes of fighting near Richmond, Virginia. On this date in 1936, Allen Ginsberg was born. He was a famous American poet who was known as a leader of the Beat Generation. His poetry was very liberal for its day, and his book, Howl, was even forbidden to be published, until the court said it was not without redeeming social importance and could continue to be sold. That's all for today, but please come back again tomorrow for another As It Is program on VOA. World news is yours at the beginning of the hour. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington.
The Agriculture Report is next, followed by Science in the News. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Agriculture Report. The United Nations says the world's population will increase by 34% by the year 2050. Scientists and others know it will be difficult to meet the food needs of so many people. A recent study shows that soybean crops and computers may help deal with the problem. The UN predicts food production must increase by 70% to meet the needs of a richer population. The UN expects more people will live in cities than in rural areas. But today, there is little to no increase in the productivity of major crops. Kenneth Quinn is the president of the World Food Prize Foundation. He says the need to increase food production is the greatest difficulty humanity has ever faced.
There's going to be another 2 billion people on our planet between now and 2050. And how are we going to produce enough food for them to eat?
Darren Drury is a scientist at the American Space Agency, NASA. He led a study of soybeans, which NASA calls the world's most important protein crop. He says researchers, using a computer, were surprised to find that they were able to create a soybean plant that can be both more productive and use less water.
We find that there are changes to the architecture of modern soybean cultivars that can be made to help us improve on many of these goals.
Researchers were able to increase soybean productivity by 7% without using more water. The computer helped researchers do work that would have taken many years in the field. The next step is to test the computer's design. We spoke to Stephen Long about that. He is a professor at the University of Illinois and one of the writers of the report on the soybean study. He told us by Skype that researchers used a computer program to study what would happen if they changed the way the plant grows.
One of the things the modeling has predicted is that there's too much leaf area. So we're actually removing leaves as the plant's growing to get a lower leaf area. We're also artificially modifying the angle of the leaves as well to reflect what the model predicted.
Professor Long says it is important to find solutions to the predicted global food shortage before it happens. He says it will be 20 years before farmers can begin growing a more productive soybean once they have developed it. The study on soybeans was published in the journal Global Change Biology. The National Science Foundation, NASA, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation paid for the study. And that's the VOA Learning English Agriculture Report. I'm Katie Weaver.
From VOA Learning English, this is Science in the News. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Christopher Cruz. Today on the program, we tell about the winners of a major environmental prize. We also tell about the First Amendment of China's environmental protection law since 1989. And we report on a new international agreement to protect the world's oceans.
Six environment activists recently received the 2014 Goldman Environmental Prize. The Goldman Prize is presented every year. The $175,000 award recognizes people who have struggled against opposition to protect the world. One of the six winners is Desmond Dassaw of South Africa. He grew up in Durban and worked in a chemical factory, gas and oil processing centers, paper mills, and chemical factories surrounded his poor working-class neighborhood. Half of the 300,000 people who live there have asthma, a disease affecting their lungs, and many suffer from cancer. An industrial explosion led Desmond Dassaw to organize opposition to expansion of a toxic landfill near his neighborhood. Harmful wastes were left in the area. Mr. Dassaw describes the effort he organized.
We have health workshops. We take bucket samples to ensure that they know what's causing all the illnesses. And so we've developed the knowledge base. We have agitated. We have lobbied. We were able, for the first time in the history of this country, to get the industry bosses to be held accountable for their actions.
The landfill was forced to close. Mr. Dassaw is now fighting plans to expand the port of Durban. The expansion would increase pollution and displace thousands of people without paying for their land. He is working on this campaign even after threats to his life and property.
But we've shown that as a united force, we can stop environmental racism. And we've shown communities that there needs to be a new way of doing business.
Biologist Rudy Putra of Indonesia is the Goldman Prize winner representing island nations. The majority of the world's palm oil grows in those countries. The oil is used in everything from cookies, chocolate and baby food, to beauty and soap products. Palm oil plantations or farms are replacing the forests in Sumatra. That Indonesian island rates among the planet's richest in differing ecosystems, a community of organisms and their environment. He has succeeded in getting village chiefs, local officials, and the police to join him on his personal campaign. But he says there is much more to do.
Recently, we started an international petition against damage to the ecosystem, and we got over 1.4 million signatures worldwide, which were submitted to the Indonesian government to cancel their plans to develop the rainforest here. We are determined to win this battle, too.
Scientist Suren Gazarian from Russia represents Europe in the 2014 Goldman Awards. He organized a blockade to stop plans by former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev to build a home in protected forest land near the Black Sea. President Vladimir Putin had removed the area's guarantee of legal protection to permit work on the project to continue.
We started a social media campaign against the project that recruited 10,000 people. This showed the public that the very people responsible for creating these laws were the first to violate them.
Suren Gazarian won that battle. He returned to the Black Sea to fight the building of a summer house for President Putin in a protected old-growth forest. The scientist was falsely accused of threatening security guards and fled to avoid prison. Today, he continues his environmental work in Estonia.
Looking forward, my main goal is to continue to try to change people's consciousness so that they better understand that nature isn't something we can just sell off and get rich on. We have to preserve these places for future generations.
Other Goldman Prize winners include Ramesh Agrawal from India. He began a successful campaign to stop a huge coal mining project in an area already affected by pollution. He launched the campaign from his small internet cafe. Ruth Buendia from Peru is another winner. She caused suspension of work on a dam. The dam would have displaced thousands of native people. Finally, American lawyer Helen Slache used her legal knowledge and skills to defend many towns set for gas drilling operations. The Goldman Environmental Prize is in its 25th year. Over time, it has been awarded to 163 activists from 82 countries.
China's parliament has passed a measure that observers say will help the country fight pollution. The new law increases the actions that environmental organizations may take against polluters. The law also identifies geographical red lines, areas that require special protection, and it gives Chinese officials more power to punish offenders. Experts say the law will help force government officials and businesses to work for stronger protection of the environment. This marks the first time China's environmental protection law has been amended since 1989.
Lawmaker Xin Chuying says the amendment will have an important effect on the future of China's environmental protection efforts. The revision of the environmental law is a heavy blow in the fight against our country's harsh environmental realities.
China's growing economy has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, but the country has suffered heavy environmental damage from its fast development. Many Chinese are dissatisfied with high levels of air, water, and soil pollution. The government has said that China places importance on the environment. But for many years, local governments have been judged only on their economic performance. Xu Nan is deputy editor of China Dialogue, a website that watches environmental issues. A prominent change in this revision is that the administration of the environment has been given a legal framework. Some of the concerns included in the law were already somewhat in practice, but now we have a legal framework. This means that in China now, there is a stronger and more official system of duty. The amendment gives environmental agencies legal power to seize offending polluters and demand severe punishment. It states that citizens have the right to collect information about the environment.
2 years passed before China's parliament was able to approve the measure. Lawmakers rejected three earlier versions, a mark of the fierce battle of interests behind the law. Class action cases against polluters were one major issue. The amendment has extended the right to act in environmental cases. Chinese media say more than 300 organizations can now take legal action to represent those harmed by pollution. On paper, the changes satisfy a number of demands that have been growing among China's civil society. Still, observers say they will watch carefully to see how the new rules are enacted. Shunan says this is true for any kind of new legislation in China. She says just gaining official legal guidance is a good step.
Experts on the health of oceans recently called for action to fight climate change, overfishing, habitat loss, and pollution. The experts met in The Hague at a conference with a very long name, the Global Oceans Action Summit for Blue Growth and Food Security. The Netherlands was the host country for the summit. The country united with summit organizers and two international agencies to announce a joint effort on ocean health. The two are the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Bank.
Valerie Hickey works for the World Bank. She says the conference brought together over 600 people to discuss how best to support what she called broad-based blue growth food security.
This was about making sure that we can invest in the oceans in a way that alleviates poverty, that shares broad prosperity while turning down the heat.
Ms. Hickey is the World Bank's sector manager for agriculture and environmental services. She says general agreement was possible at the Ocean Summit, unlike many meetings on climate change. She says summit delegates did not negotiate over the wording of a final statement. Instead, she says, the summit was a chance for more than 80 officials to promise, in her words, real action in real time. Ms. Hickey said it was not necessary for people to speak only from government positions. She said the delegates agreed on a three-part plan to protect the oceans. She said the first part would be to set up partnerships.
We need to bring in the private sector. We need to increase our investments in small and medium-sized enterprises, because at the end of the day, it's local communities, it's family fishers, it's small-scale fishers who are going to drive broad-based blue growth in the ocean space.
She says the delegates also talked about the need to speed up action to make sure they can end illegal, ungoverned, and unreported fishing. The third part of the plan, she says, calls for financing from new places and new partners to support blue growth programs. Ms. Hickey says she is sure that these suggestions will move from promises to action.
Absolutely. I can say personally that we as the World Bank are committed to following up on the actions that we promised to do after the summit. It includes helping countries to undertake natural capital accounting of their ocean resources so they can begin to realize real returns from their ocean assets in a sustainable way.
Netherlands Agriculture Minister Sharon Dijksma was the chairperson of the summit. She praised the world community for showing a desire to move forward and act on ocean health and food security.
This Science in the News was written by Geraldine Watson. It was based on stories from VOA reporters Joe DiCapua, Roseanne Skirbel, and Rebecca Valley. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Christopher Cruz. Join us again next week for more news about science on the Voice of America.